Tonight on Arena, it's 25 years since the release of Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill, and poet Jane Clark on her new collection, When the Tree Falls. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Whether it's authors, screenwriters, musicians or visual artists, current restrictions on movement mean that for many in the artistic community, the home has now become the centre of creativity. But even if you're not a full-time artist, your home is full of materials just waiting to be put to artistic use. And based on their own extremely creative endeavours, my next two guests are here to give you tips as to how to do just that. Set designer Mally O'Cahyne has been recreating some of the world's most famous paintings with people, namely her parents, and materials in her own home. And arts facilitator, Kira Harrison has been casting an artistic photographic eye on both the people and everyday objects in her own home. Both have shared their endeavours on their respective Instagram pages, and they join me on the line now. Mally, I'll start with you because some of the images that we'll speak about in your case will be immediately familiar to people. I'll start with the Kiss, famous Gustav Klimt painting. But when you get your hands on it, it's your mum and dad that are having that famous Klimt kiss. Where did this idea come from?
Hi. It came from, we were sort of just bored one night on about maybe night six of lockdown and decided that I thought, well, we need a distraction. I was unexpectedly stuck in Ireland and live in London currently. And so dreamt up that we should start recreating portraits based on the tweets I'd seen from the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam suggesting that people recreate art as a lockdown hobby.
Was the Kiss one of the very early ones that you tackled? Or was it night
yeah,
six,
I think
you
it
say?
Was day four or something like that.
Right.
So we started with a Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera's portrait. And then, oh no, American Gothic was the first one, then Frida right. and Diego, and then the Kiss was day three.
So, people will know that image. And what struck me immediately was, I mean, this is not an easy thing to take on. It's got such this gold leaf sheen on it, incredible cloak that is embraced, sort of enveloping the two lovers as they kiss. How did you finding things in your house that would recreate that type of image? How difficult was it? Or do you have a very colourful house?
Well, this isn't my home normally. I've never lived in this house before lockdown. It's my parents' house that I was visiting for a few days when I got stuck here. So there is quite a lot of textiles and things in the house because my mum is a textile artist. But there's primarily it's like using quite recognisable IKEA cushion covers and bits of yellow blankets and some scarves. And my dad has a T-shirt of my mum's draped over his shoulder. And, I couldn't find a yellow thing for him to wear, so he's wearing a blue thing. So it is sort of improvised in the moment and just trying to find, I suppose, shop around the house for the, and hunt around the house for the objects that sort of best either respond to the colour needed or the shape or the texture.
Yeah, and I suppose it's hardly surprising that in a number of the portraits that you've done, I presume you must be doing near enough one a day, maybe more than one a day at this point along the way. It's often parents of the artists or parents or a couple that has been painted by the particular artist, and then you transfer that over onto your own mother and father, whose names we should give, by the way, since they're the stars of these paintings.
Liz and Brian are their names. Yeah, we did 53 days uninterrupted.
Yeah.
And then a few days ago, I actually decided to take a little break. I think we were all just a little bit exhausted and realised that I'd gotten through 53 days of lockdown and hadn't really watched a single movie because I had been doing this every evening. So for all of our sanity, we've taken a short break. But I think we're going to go back and do a final couple before I eventually try and travel back to the UK for work.
Yeah, let me just ask you about one before I go to speak to Sarah about what she's doing. The Golden Wedding, which is a painting by Pompeo Massani, and it shows a couple in bed. A couple who are not in the first flowers of youth, let us put it that way.
Sure.
Nice little embrace. They're celebrating their golden wedding. Now, your version of that is the Pearl Wedding 2020. Was there actually a Pearl Wedding anniversary celebrated by your parents this year?
There is a Pearl Wedding anniversary to be celebrated on June 21st this year.
Ah, right. Well, now they have the picture for it. Just remind me how many years is Pearl. I forgot to check this myself.
30. I think it's 30,
30
anyways. They're 30. Celebrating 30 years. I'm pretty sure it's Pearl.
Right, so, and they're using
so
Pearl
to celebrate.
So they'll
have lots of good photographs to choose between for their Pearl wedding portrait.
Okay, listen, let me go to Kira Harrison at this point. I think I called you Sarah a minute ago for some reason, Kira. Now, you're doing something similar. You're doing something similar to what Molly is doing, Kira. But in your case, it's totally new images. You're basically... tell me the name of the project, first of all, and that will give us a sense of what you're doing.
Well, I'm calling it Part of the Furniture. It came about because I found myself wearing clothes that were matching the kitchen tiles. And I just asked my sister to photograph me lying on them, not really thinking it was going to evolve into anything much more. But then started thinking about the idea of when you're in one place for such a long time, would you start to somehow become part of the furniture and begin to blend in, like so many of the objects we have at home that probably a lot of people are starting to notice a bit more than normal now.
Yeah, and you say it's called Part of the Furniture, and that in itself has a kind of a pun aspect to it. But the titles that you've given to some of the specific images that you've managed to create, similarly, you seem to enjoy making the title as much as anything else. Describe Sleeping in the Creeper to me, because I don't even know how you managed to get up into this creeper without breaking your own neck in the process.
Oh, yes. Well, that was my mum's idea, and she's quite a keen gardener. So she was able to predict that, you know, in a week's time, you're going to be able to get up onto that creeper and camouflage yourself into it. And so we sourced the outfit, got the ladder prepared, and it was surprisingly comfortable, actually, once I got up there.
Yeah, I love
poke around to make sure I wasn't interfering with any bees.
Yeah, a couple of things that you're saying there. We sourced the outfit. Now, the creeper that your mother, I'm sure she could give us the botanical name and the exact name of the flower. Maybe you can too. It's a lovely pink star-shaped flower all over the back wall of the garden. It struck me kind of crawling along the top of it. You got these floral tights, which you sourced, you say. You also got a lovely floral dress, which you sourced. And you blend perfectly. It's just your head and shoulders that's coming up out of the bush. Everything else seems to be part of the bush. How do you mean you source them? Are there a lot of clothes around the house?
There are a number of clothes hidden in this house. There was at one stage 4 women living here. So there's either clothes that's being stored in the attic or that's being abandoned in wardrobes. So we've got a serious collection to choose from.
Yeah, I've often heard the argument.
So that particular plant was Clematis montana, I think it's known as.
Yeah, I have a funny feeling that your mother has just put a bit of paper in front of your nose at the phone there. Perhaps she'd maybe not. Yeah, kind of clematis anyway. Yeah, and it does look, it looks absolutely beautiful. And the image within it looks great as well. I've heard the argument put that if you keep clothes long enough, that eventually they will come back into fashion. One of the excuses for having an extended wardrobe, I'm told. Did you ever have any idea that this was the use that you would put clothes to? What's your own background?
Well, my background is in textiles. And now I still do some textiles, but mostly work with groups. But I think it might be a trait of people involved with textiles to source and keep fabrics for a very long time. And I do have a love of dress and clothes and costumes. So, things don't tend to be given away very often. And most things are sourced from charity shops and that where I say, well, sell them on, but they end up staying there and I just admire them.
Yeah, you sell them
so
on to
I'm
the wardrobe.
Glad they're getting finally. Yeah.
Let me go back to
so
Molly.
Finally getting a bit of publicity.
Absolutely. Let me go back to Molly then. Molly, a background in textiles in the case of Kira there. In your case, the background is in theatre. You work as a set designer. Do you think that has fed into in any way the kind of paintings you've chosen in some ways, or indeed the staging of them? Because that's what you're doing. You're restaging the paintings. Has your theatrical background helped that?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose it is exactly as you say, it is a staging. And I think in terms of choice of images, Well, I suppose firstly, I've been looking for ones with two people in them that feel achievable. But also, I guess I'd look for something harder to pinpoint exactly what it is that is some sort of story or drama or intrigue that's held in the original that I want to recreate, particularly when choosing the kind of lesser known paintings and photographs. I think the iconic ones sort of speak for themselves as to why they have an appeal to recreate, because they are well known and well loved, and therefore there's a kind of naturally sort of fun, they're fun to look at for that reason, whereas the ones that are more obscure, I've chosen for a variety of different reasons, but that's definitely one of them. And then I think in terms of theatre and staging, you know, the theatre industry is currently entirely on pause, more or less. There's some great work being done online, but other than that, we're on ice, and that's been very difficult for all of the wonderful collaborators and colleagues that I work with across my industry. And I think we've all found different ways of having to sort of channel what we're missing into, and this is where I've ended up sort of unintentionally channeling that need I have myself.
How important is that, Ciara? Because again, you've mentioned you have a background in textiles, but you also have a background, I believe, in art and health. You work in the National Gallery, isn't it? That you're involved in a kind of an outreach project, I think, in some ways that brings art and health together. To what extent is what you're doing part of keeping your mental health well and in a good state during this period?
Yeah, it's with the nature of the work that I do, similar to Molly, it's all temporarily gone, because it involves working so much with people one on one, and often I'm working with older people and children and people who could be quite vulnerable. So yeah, for me, this has been just a really important outlet to have, and quite unexpected, really. But it's been just a nice way to absorb myself, I guess, in something, and to have something that defines each day. It's become about just getting through each day, as opposed to looking so far ahead.
Fair enough, and quite a good way of doing that. Just one final question to you then, Molly. Most of them are fairly straightforward, but you had to ask a lot of your father when it came to recreating Annie Leibovitz and the famous picture of Yoko Ono and John Lennon. Yoko Ono fully clothed, John Lennon not quite. Yes, a little less so. Thank you for that delicate description. How difficult was that? Was it a difficult job to persuade him, or was he up for the fun, your dad?
Well, he was up for it. And I mean, I think I've gotten that question a lot, and it sort of almost freaks me out. The idea that I would force or coerce him, it seems horrifying. Yeah. I would never do anything with anyone, any participant or collaborator that they strongly felt they didn't want to do. I think consent in all things is incredibly important. So he was really up for it. And I think because both of my parents, you know, they know those people, they know that photograph, and they admire both of the artists portrayed in the original. And so it's such a beautiful photograph, and it's such a powerful depiction of a relationship. And I think in looking at this project, it's been interesting to look at how people portray relationships. Some of them self-portraits, some of them taken by photographers or painted by other painters, and some of them, as you said, paintings of artist parents. You know, it's all different ways of viewing sort of that partnership, which I think is kind of interesting.
Indeed, and both of you have given us quite a lot to look at on Instagram. I certainly had fun this afternoon going through both sets of recreations, paintings, collages, settings, stagings, whatever we want to call them. Molly O'Cahyne there, and set designer Molly O'Cahyne, arts facilitator Ciara Harrison, about how they're keeping a creative focus while confined largely to their own homes. And hopefully we've given you a little inspiration. You might go off and try to recreate some things in your own home. Check out Molly's Instagram page, searchable with the name Molly Freya, that's Freja, and then Ciara's page is Ciara Harrison _maker. Now, in recent times, we've been delving into the treasure trove that is the RTE Radio Archive, and as you can imagine, we've uncovered several gems, including Classic Cut, a short-form audio series made by our very own arena producer, Sinead Egan. In 2008, Sinead spoke to well-known figures and writers about their favourite films. So here's Cullum Tobin on the 1974 classic Chinatown.
The film is about water, It's about Los Angeles, where there's no water, where water is immensely valuable, and of a very, very dark forces involved. And in the middle of all this is actually a very simple figure who's played by Jack Nicholson.
Forget it, will you, Curly? I only brought it up to illustrate a point. I don't want your last dime. What kind of a guy do you think I am?
Thank you, Mr. Gitter.
Call me Jake. Careful driving home, girl, huh?
We learn that our hero has been in the police force in Chinatown. That whatever happened to him before, which isn't told to us, disgraced him enough that he had to leave. And it seems to have to do with a woman. But he's now alone. And of course, out of his depth.
Yeah, listen, pal, I make an honest living. People only come to me when they're in a desperate situation. I help them out. I don't kick families out of their houses like you bums down at the bank,
Jake. Can I tell you about the guy who
maybe like to step down out of the barber chair? Maybe we go outside and discuss it. What do you think?
Nicholson thinks he understands things, but he doesn't understand the forces at work, which are making fortunes all around him. Well, he's really just a two-bit private investigator whose job is, you know, if a man thinks his wife is cheating on him, he sets a detective to take photographs of where she's going, what she's doing, and the guy pays him. You know, he's doing that sort of work. And one day, somebody comes to tell him that she is Mrs. Mulray, and she turns out not to be. Now, there's a sensational sequence where the real Mrs. Mulray arrives.
Have we ever met?
Well, no.
Never?
Never.
That's what I thought. You see, I'm Mrs. Evelyn Mulray. You know Mr. Mulray's wife?
Not, that Mulray.
Yes, Mr. Giddy's that Mulray. And since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I see you like publicity, Mr. Giddy's. Well, you're going to get it.
Now, wait a minute, Mrs. Mulray. I think there's been some misunderstanding here. There's no point in getting tough with me.
Don't get tough with anyone, Mr. Giddy's. My lawyer does.
I think you also can love the film just for the beauty of the screenplay, for the amount of smart talk, for that every line of dialogue, say, does something wonderful and sparkling.
They don't. It seems like half the city is trying to cover it all up, which is fine by me. But Mrs. Mulray, I goddamn near lost my nose, and I like it. I like breathing through it. And I still think that you're hiding something.
I think that Dunaway puts on an astonishing performance in the film. She looks, first of all, so absolutely wonderful. The clothes, the gestures, the eyes, the hair, the dignity.
How much would you like?
I'll stop it. The money's fine. It's generous. But, I think you shortchanged me on the story.
I have.
I think so. Something else besides the death of your husband was bothering you. You were upset, but not that upset.
Mr. Giddy's, don't tell me how I feel.
I suppose the ending really satisfied me because it was a European ending, because it wasn't a happy ending in any way. There was a pure tragic sense, which in a way arose from Polanski's own background and appears in other of his films and something he was terribly interested in. You know, and this is not a film in which Americans can get any hope from. Americans like hope, the audacity of hope. Well, I thought this was a sensibility that came straight out of Poland in difficult years to tell them that there wasn't any hope.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Get off the street!
I love the idea that the film is called Chinatown. I love titles like that sometimes. It leads you astray for a while and then leads you back. But it's not called like Private Detective or Irrigation or Orange Groves, Chinatown.
25 minutes past seven on Tuesday night's Arena. In 1995, the 21-year-old singer-songwriter Alanis Morissette released Jagged Little Pill. She'd already released two albums, but after being dropped by her label, she decided to follow her gut and make the music she wanted to make, music that involved songs drawn from personal experiences, bad relationships, career problems, jealousy. By November 1995, Jagged Little Pill had sold more than 2 million copies. Clearly, its themes resonated with her newfound audience. Kate Brennan-Harding will be speaking to me shortly about what makes Jagged Little Pill so important. But first, let's hear the debut single from the album, You Ought to Know.
I want you to know that I'm happy for you. I wish nothing but the best for you both. I know the version of me. Is she perverted like me? Would she go down on you in a theater? Does she speak eloquently?
I'm here to remind you of the mess you left when you went away. The chorus there of You Ought to Know, track from Jagged Little Pill, 25 years old this year. And Alanis Morissette, it was really the album that launched her into international stardom. Kate Brennan-Harding has been re-listening to the album, and she's with me this evening to talk about it. That was the song, I think, that first caught your attention, You Ought
to Know. Completely, completely. And do you know how hard it was to restrain myself from singing out loud listening to that down the phone? I heard that song first on MTV, and that's how that song kind of came to prominence. It's the one that broke her. She had been going around, you know, her record label had been trying to get her on radio play, and nobody would play her because there was enough women already on radio, which was kind of mad. But K-Rock FM in LA, they put that song on the playlist, and then MTV followed, and then the international release of the album happened. And I was 15, and that song, I didn't actually know what some of the lyrics meant, but I knew I wanted to find out, and I knew I had to know who this woman was. So that song, I think it's a good 8 months after the album was released that I bought the album. And I picked it up. It wasn't going to be something that was completely my cup of tea, because at that stage I'd sort of decided, I like Oasis and I like Britpop, and you know, if not, I like dance music. So this was a kind of different sound for me. And I've talked about this before, where the album Jagged Little Pill, it kind of became something that I grew into, because it's like that I didn't understand some of the themes, but I loved the fact that this woman was singing so powerfully about them. And I didn't relate to some of the songs yet, but the more I listened, the more I just completely identified with it and felt a power from it and a vulnerability with it. And that's exactly what Alanis still does to this day.
That, even that song title, You Ought to Know, it's like, sit down, in her case, I think it's probably, sit down, mister, I want to tell you something here. And you need to hear it. You ought to know the mess you left when you went away. That kind of directness, drawing on personal experience, direct autobiographical material, and and speaking almost aggressively, you could argue, at the person who broke her heart, or to the person that broke her heart. It both opened her up to an audience who said, yeah, I want to say that to somebody, or I want to say something like that to somebody. But it also alienated her from people. Why do you think it caused some people such problems that she was being that direct?
Well, because, you know, a woman speaking their mind, sometimes people have problems with that. Do you know what I mean? I think I remember being on the show recently talking about Fiona Apple doing the same thing. You know, it sort of polarizes people. I think some people feel like they can't relate, and, oh my God, she's just shouting. Whereas actually the majority of people, 33 million to be precise at this time, can relate to her. And regardless of whether you're male or female, we've all experienced that jealousy and that spurned lover kind of, you know, thing that happens. And it's the rage, this visceral thing that comes with it. And it's like, it's not celebrated. That is a powerful way of expressing the hurt when that happens to you, you know?
And I was saying, actually, by the way, the next time you listen to You Ought to Know, which is, I remember from the time, do you know the line, she speaks eloquently? She actually says there, she speaks Gaelic like me. Next time you listen, say that lyric, I guarantee you it fits perfectly.
Forever imprinted
in my brain. But let's talk about, you know, I said in the introduction she was 21. She'd already had two albums.
Yeah.
So who was she at that time, and what musical context was she coming into and was she performing in?
Yeah, so before in Canada, she'd had two albums previously released, and both of those were like dance pop. They were not the sound that she comes out with in Jagged Little Pill. And she had gotten those records, you know, she got that record deal when she was in high school. There was a two record deal, and her publisher didn't get another record label to be interested in publishing basically another third album. But what happened was her publisher thought, you're great, and I'm going to introduce you to this songwriter in LA called Glenn Ballard. So she flew down to LA, she met him. Within an hour, they'd written a song together. That song is called The Bottom Line, and it's featured on, you know, a rework, which was released a few years ago. But within a couple of minutes, they really clicked. And what they decided to do was write the songs together. So what they did was they wrote 20 songs in total. And what they did was they wrote a song a day. So they'd go in and they'd write and record. And Glenn would put guitar and melody down and Alanis would sing. And basically she sang the songs in one or two takes. And that's what you hear on the album. She never redid them. That's what you hear on the album. So, you know, she decided that she was going to be her own voice. She was going to write something that was more in standing with where she was at the time. And also moving out of Canada and down to LA must have been a hugely big, important moment for her to be working with somebody else as well. And he was bringing in, Glenn was bringing in people like Dave Navarro from the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Flea. They actually play on You Ought to Know. They're instrumental in that. So like there's a whole world opened up to her and she's just laying her cards on the table with this new sound. It's also the first album that was released internationally. So it's technically her first album internationally.
Yeah.
Her previous albums are only released domestically in Canada.
And is that of those first two albums, is she recognisable? Is the Alanis Morissette that came in Jagged Little Pill and the later albums, is she recognisable?
Just her vocals, do you know? Mm. They are dance pop, which I suppose, like there's been reworks of her songs done by Freemasons like they did on Uninvited, and Thank You has also been reworked. So you can hear that she does, her vocals lend themselves, like Donna Summer, I suppose, you know, to dance music because of how pure they are. But with expressing herself in Jagged Little Pill and then from, you know, going on to supposed infatuation junkie, she basically found that grunge sound and indie sound was more how she could express herself. So she came into her own.
Yeah. Let's listen to it. Let's go a little bit further down the track listing and a song called Perfect. She's kind of talking here. I heard I was listening to something today. I'll tell you a little bit more about it later. But where she basically says this song is about the plight of the overachiever, which some people might say, oh, get over yourself.
No, I don't think so. I think that's, you know, she's speaking more about being pressurized and having society and parental pressure. And it's the song that actually gave me the key to unlock the rest of the album for me, because I sat there crying listening to this song because I had felt under so much pressure. And this was a person singing about the same feelings I had in my head.
Perfect from Jagged Little Pill.
Be a good girl. You gotta try.
Perfect from the album Jagged Little Pill. 25 years old, that album is this year in June. In fact, I think is the specific date of the release. And Kate Brennan Harding is speaking about the album with me this evening.
When you hear that song, like it's well, it also to me now, I hear an inner critic. Do you know? That's how that song relates to me now. So it's kind of like it's grown through the years.
Yeah.
You know?
And the other side of it is, you know, when I asked you the question beforehand about, you know, some people get annoyed about you and might say, oh, well, isn't it very sad for you being perfect? But when you actually listen to that, gone is all the supposed shouting. Gone is the, you know, barking lyrics at you. That's a plaintive plea of, you know, I'm feeling shock and pressure here and it's just not easy.
Exactly. And given the fact that she had signed she'd created two albums while she was in high school. You know, you can see that teenage angst in that. Do you know what I mean? That she's like, she's trying her best to be perfect. I think as well, like the album for me, having had a look back over the last few weeks, which is something that I just put on and I wouldn't think back on and analyse it anymore. But actually going back and analysing it more now, I think that the album is split into different parts. And like, it opens with All I Really Want, then You Ought to Know, which you played, and then Perfect. And it's like coming out of You Ought to Know, that really, you know, rage-filled song, straight into Perfect, where you're suddenly, she's displaying her vulnerabilities and her you know, anxiety about not getting it right. It's really beautiful because it does bring the listener straight in to like, oh, okay, she's not just rage-filled. She's everything. She's expressing everything of who she is.
I was listening, I was telling you, I was listening to her speaking earlier on today. It was on Spotify, in fact. There's this landmark thing. I don't know if you've ever listened to any of this, where they basically take a big album and some of the artists are interviewed, and it's Alanis Morissette and Glenn Ballard talking about the specifics of the song. She mentions, you know, they talked about philosophy. They had lunch, talked about philosophy, talked about psychology, then went back into the studio in the afternoon, wrote a song. That was how it worked. But the psychology, I thought, was interesting in all of this, because this is an album that talks about, you know, it's certainly jealousy, mental illness, codependencies, their friendship, self-esteem, infidelity. I was interested in the fact that she isolated out psychology as a major interest of hers.
Yeah, and like she now has her podcast, and she looks, you know, she works with mental health. She is always analysing herself. So I suppose this album is the first draft in that. Do you know what I mean? It's much more personal than what had gone before because they were pop records. So yeah, you can totally find, you know, understand why she has always been delving into psychiatry and psychology, you know.
Let's have a little listen to a part of pop, probably one of the biggest hits from the album, Ironic. That's Ironic from Jagged Little Pill, and celebrating the 25th anniversary of the release of that album. With me this evening is Kate Brennan-Harding. Again, a song that landed her in all sorts of troubles, but, you know, she talks about she was having fun. She was having wordplay in the lyrics of that song.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I suppose as well with age, I can be more laughing and joking and, you know, free around this song. Like I'll just like be straight up, like, I love this album. But back when that song was a single, it was overplayed and I was driven demented by it. And then came the part which happens a lot of musicians where people think, oh, suddenly they drop it. It's uncool to like Alanis. But it's certainly cool again to like her. And that song, it may not be ironic, but it's fun. And again, like Glenn and her talked about how they wrote that song, where she, again, they used to write every day. They'd go, they had a routine, they'd go to an Italian restaurant and have a nice meal and then talk about what the theme of the song they were going to write was. And she just said, it'd be ironic if a guy won the lotto and then died the next day. And that's where the song came from. And they just are constantly pillared for it. And it's like, it's just fun. It's just fun. And I tell you something, I am bereft because festivals are not happening for me this year. And one of my biggest moments has been Aoife McElwain. She started Sing Along Social and yelling that at the top of my voice with 1,000 other people in a field was one of my favourite moments last year.
Well, let's hope that you get the opportunity to mark the 25th anniversary with the show that Alanis Morissette is planning in October in the Three Arena. Let's hope that it will go ahead. She's hosting a live stream tonight with the cast of the musical based on Jagged Little Pill. And that's all going to raise funds for the Actors Fund. Has the album stood the test of time, Kate?
Absolutely. I think the album is completely one of those that stands out. If it was to be released today, I think it would be just as important as it was back in 1995. I think she has, I think actually it might be received even better this time around because people are not as separated with male and female artists. I mean, there's still a problem of sexism in the industry, but, you know, I think she would be higher, more received and people would be more open to it.
Great. Well, listen, we're going to finish up by listening to Hand in Your Pocket. One Hand in Your Pocket. Brilliant. Isn't that correct? Yeah. And in fact, I think she said in that thing I was listening to today that this was the first time that she totally wrote the lyrics by herself.
Yes.
Ballard went off and left her by herself and she said, I have some lyrics. So we'll listen to that shortly. But let me just thank you, first of all, Kate Brennan-Harding, for speaking to us. And the live stream with Alanis Morissette is on the Jagged Little Pill YouTube channel. And that's at 1 a.m. this evening if you're if you're a bit of a night owl. Yeah, we'll stay up. Let's finish up with One Hand in Your Pocket. Hand in My Pocket from Jagged Little Pill, the album that celebrates its 25th anniversary this year from Alanis Morissette. Jagged Little Pill on Arena. Isn't it iconic? Now, I should clarify something immediately. A misunderstanding on my part. I thought I was being given a very funny line to deliver, but only when I read it properly did I realise it was somebody else's funny line. Jagged Little Pill, Isn't It Iconic? That was a tweet from Donal O'Keefe. So apologies for stealing it from you, Donal. It's your line and you can hold on to it. Like many other festivals this year, the Stole Writers Week will not be going ahead in its usual format next week, but it's all important. Literary competitions continue apace. The shortlist has just been announced for the Pigott Poetry Prize Award 2020, adjudicated this year by the Barnsley poet and BBC4 regular Ian McMillan. More than 60 collections were submitted for the prize, now in its seventh year, and the three books on the shortlist are When the Tree Falls by Jane Clarke, What Planet by Miriam Gamble and Pigeon Songs by Owen Walls. Jane Clarke joins me now from Glenmalure in County Wicklow. Congrats, first of all, on the shortlisting, Jane, but you have form at Listowel, it has to be said.
Yes, thanks very much, Sean. Yeah, Listowel has been very good to me over the years. I did my first writing workshop there in 2005 with Tony Glavin. And then I won a single poem prize there in 2007. And then my first collection, The River, won the first poetry collection prize in 2014. And then the inaugural Listowel Writers' Week Poem of the Year Award. So Listowel has been very generous to me.
Yeah, three prizes there to boast about, if you like. And in fact, the Irish Poem of the Year was for one of the poems that's in this new collection, In Glasnevin. You're at a gravestone. The poet, or the person speaking in the poem here, is at the gravestone of Elizabeth O'Farrell and Julia Grennan, who took part in the Easter Rising. What particularly struck you that you wanted to write about O'Farrell and Grennan?
Well, it was the words on their gravestone, it's faithful comrade, lifelong friend. And I don't know this, but I wondered, were they love partners? Mm-hmm. And I wondered what it would be like at that time. Could they have been open? What would it have been like if they had been open, and probably they weren't able to be, about their relationship? So it was really, the poem was what I would have liked to ask them. And so that's what it came from. But it was also thoughts about, a lot of the women involved in 1916, they then went into this terribly conservative Ireland. And I was thinking about how disappointing and disillusioning it must have been for all of them, and, people like Kathleen Lynn. So that they're the two themes in the poem.
The new collection then, When the Tree Falls, wonderful title, and I know you credit Mary Lavin and the short story In the Middle of the Fields for that line, When the Tree Falls. But it brings you back to County Roscommon, and that was there in your first collection as well, The River in 2015. But it was specifically, I suppose, the illness and death of your father that brought you back home, sent you homeward bound.
Yeah, it was the circumstances that in the 4 years I was writing the collection, my father was very ill, and then he died in January 2016. And so I was writing about particularly the intensity of the 2 months when we nursed him at home. And so, I was writing during that time a little bit, notes. But then after he died, I just wrote and wrote and wrote about that time. And, I found it helpful it kind of accompanied my grieving. The writing, the poems accompanied my grieving.
Would you tell me a little bit about where that I could, the poem that you're going to read for us now, where that came in the midst of all that, in the midst of that grieving? I think the fact that you were in Spain when your father was ill is an important part of this poem.
Yes, I was actually on a writing workshop in Spain, and I couldn't. My father was taken into Portiuncla Hospital in Ballinasloe, and I couldn't get home in time, and so it was that kind of longing to be there and the wish to be able to take away his pain, and you know it does remind me of what it must be like for people at the moment when they have someone, a loved one in hospital, and they can't be with them. Mm.
Will you read That I Could for us then?
That I could. That I could take away from him these long days in the hospital, the digging for a vein in his arm, the drip that stops him sleeping, the pain that makes him whisper, Jesus Christ, oh Jesus Christ. That I could take him back to his cobblestones and barn, his rooks and the birch trees, his nettles and ditches, limestone and bog. That I could find the words to tell him what he will always be, horse chestnut petals falling pink in the yard, the well hidden in a blackthorn thicket, a summer evening's hush, cattle standing orange in the shallows.
And that's Jane Clark reading from her poem, reading her poem there, That I Could, from her collection When the Tree Falls, which has been shortlisted for a prize at this year's Listowel Writers Festival. Obviously, referring specifically to your father in that poem, Jane, but the elegiac tone, it extends beyond that into the loss of your friend, Shirley McClure.
Yes, and Shirley is was very highly considered poet, and we were poet companions. We'd been friends since college, since Trinity days. Mm-hmm. We had set up a poetry workshop group together. We set up a poetry reading group together, and so she was ill in the years, for about 4 years, and died in September 2016. With my anxiety about both my father and Shirley and my closeness to both of them, and then the grieving for both of them really in the months afterwards really did shape this collection.
Maybe you would read the poem Respects for me at this point, Jane, because, while you speak brilliantly about that, the grief that you experienced in the death of both your father and your friend Shirley McClure, you had the process of having a funeral and being able to mourn things properly. And Respects reminds us maybe in some ways of what people are not able to do right now. Would you read it for us?
I will, yes. Respects. From Kiltoon, Cremulley, Loughlin, Kilbegnet, Le Carro, At League, Craigs, Carrakeel, Ballinleg, they come to pay their respects. They shake hands with us, stand by his body and bow their heads. Cattlemen, sheepmen, carpenters, teachers, foresters, nurses, vets. They say prayers, lay their hands on his chest and bless themselves. Then fill the kitchen with the man they knew. A grand man altogether, always out early, hardy as a wild duck, a good judge of a bullock. Fierce man to work. He had woeful hands, a man of his word. I slip out for a while to see an orange globe over the common and a flock of hooper swans feasting on the last of the winter grass.
Jane Clark reading her poem there, Respects. It's so tragic, Jane, when you hear it just described there, that the shaking of the hands, the consoling words, the hand on the chest of the remains, all of those things that are just absent now. It's incredibly difficult to think of how it must be for people who are trying to process and mourn the death of a loved one without that help of community.
I really agree, Sean, and I, because I, it mattered so much to us And we really felt we were helped by our, you know, our neighbours just beside us, who had been neighbours of my father all his life. But then the wider community that came, and I really noticed that people came and wrote their name and their townland on the book, you know, the book that's left. Yeah. I was really aware that people's townland really mattered to them.
I know, and it's extraordinary when you get that book of condolences after the loss of a loved one, you will go through each and every name and each and every place that they came from. And as you say, it means so much. Just knowing that they were there, you may not have had a chance to speak with them on the day, but knowing they were there is such an important part of things. And poetry, I think, is serving, we've come across it in several situations here on the programme, that poetry seems to be a thing that people are using right now to deal with the situation we're in. Briefly, why do you think that is before we go to your final poem, Julian?
Well, I think it is something about the intensity and the distillation of a poem. Like, I think a poem is like music. It goes straight to the heart. And I think that's what people want at the moment. Something that strikes that chord, yeah.
Go straight to the heart with us now with a brand new poem you have for us, The Key, set in Glenmalure, where you live. And I think it's clear when you read the poem, it'll be clear what the special day involved was here.
Okay, thank you, Sean. The Key. The house looked like home that evening in May. Honeysuckle entwined in hazel, oak coming into leaf, the stove-warmed kitchen, windows facing the hills. It rains the day we're handed the key. Linoleum curling in corners, damp patches on ceilings, blinds we can't raise. A marble rolls in an empty drawer. Heads down, eyes not meeting, we sweep and scrub. We turn up the radio, unpack boxes, place our books on shelves. Darkness tells us it's time to rest. Lifting the bedside lamp from the car, we hear the avenbeg at the end of the road. Smell hay in our neighbour's field. A horse whinnies. Venus unlocks the sky.
Jane Clark with her poem, The Key, and she was also reading poems from her latest collection, When the Tree Falls, which is shortlisted for the Pigott Poetry Prize Award 2020, which will be announced on Wednesday, the 27th of May. And the collection that Jane was speaking about, When the Tree Falls, published by Blood Axe Books. That's our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.